You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
Listen! Do I have your attention yet? Listen! I reckon Jesus would probably be gratified that today's passage is so well known. And who knows? Maybe it's because it both begins and ends with the warning to listen up. If we've learned anything about interpreting these stories, you can always tell a little bit more about them when you know the context. And apparently, in this context, people weren't listening. And truth be told, we're still not listening. From early on, the meaning of this parable has been confused in the minds of many because it's so often presented as an allegory. What's an allegory? Well, it's not a parable. An allegory is a literary device in which characters or events represent or symbolize ideas and concepts. Huh? Well, let me give you an example. Most of you know my troubled relationship with Augustine. The August saint and I do not see eye to eye on a lot of things, from his invention of the idea of original sin to his ideas about certainty. I've just never been a big fan. One more example I can point to of my dislike of Augustine is his use of allegories. A classic example is how his interpretation of the parable of the Good Samaritan totally ruins the parable. It's not good enough for Augustine to just read the parable and hear that Jesus is advocating overcoming our prejudices. No, he's got to allegorize it. So as Burton Mack points out, Augustine says, the traveler is Adam, whose fall from Jerusalem, the heavenly city, down to Jericho, the sign of the moon and mortality, makes him vulnerable to thieves. The thieves are the devil and his angels, who strip him of his immortality, pummel him into sinning, and leave him half dead in his sinful state. The priest and the Levite represent the ministry of the Old Testament, which should provide for salvation, but are not sufficient. The Good Samaritan is the Lord himself who renders aid and places Adam in the hands of the Apostle Paul. Paul keeps the inn until the morrow, when the resurrection will occur. In the meantime, Christ provides the two pence of the precepts of love and the promise of eternal life. So, the little story of the man who fell among thieves was found to rehearse the grand scheme of the Christian plan of salvation. What? The bottom line, Augustine has totally missed the whole point of the Good Samaritan. And it's not the only parable that he messes up. But here's what you need to know. Even the gospel writers themselves engage in allegory. And today's reading is one of the most allegorized of them all. Let's hear this parable again and then see if we can't get back on the other side of the allegory curtain. And don't forget, listen up!
Our words of wisdom are from Mark chapter 4, verses 2 through 9. Jesus began to teach them many things in parables. And his teachings, he said to them, listen, a sower went out to sow, and as he sowed, some seeds fell on the path, and the birds came and ate it up.
Other seed fell on rocky ground, where it did not have much soil, and it sprang up quickly, since it had no depth of soil. And when the sun rose, it was scorched. And since it had no root, it withered away.
Other seeds fell among thorns, and the thorns grew up and choked it, and it yielded no grain. Other seed fell into good soil and brought forth grain, growing up and increasing and yielding 30 and 60 and 100-fold.
And he said, let anyone with ears to hear listen.
Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
Once upon a time, there was a man who had a daughter. Her fiancé was always jumping from one job to another. And one day, the father said to the young man, I don't know what my daughter sees in you, but she says you have that certain something. I only wish you had something certain. Right? So take a look at enough parables, and you might start feeling the same way. You know they have that certain something, but sometimes it's hard to pin down something, well, certain with any of them. Today's parable is a major example of that. It's been interpreted and allegorized upside down and backwards from the very beginning. Augustine wasn't the first to allegorize Jesus' parables. Mark himself gets the prize for that. In the verses that follow our reading today, Mark does exactly what Augustine did, assigning grand ideas and concepts to the various elements in the story. And his interpretation is so familiar to us, so ingrained, pardon the pun, that it's a bit of a challenge to hear the parable of the sower as if you're hearing it for the first time. To start off, this parable is found in four of the five Gospels. Matthew and Luke copied it right out of Mark, along with his allegorical interpretation. The sower also appears in the Gospel of Thomas, but without the allegorical reading. So since Thomas is so early in the tradition, it serves as further evidence that the allegory was tacked on much later. Remember, there are no parables in the Gospel of John, so John just skips this story altogether. Following the parable in Mark, Matthew, and Luke is the allegory many of us are familiar with. The seed is the word of God, and it falls on the ear of various types of ears or soil. Only the good soil hears the word and yields fruit. In his study of the parable of the sower, Theodore Whedon constructs the earliest texts as follows. A sower went out to sow, and while sowing it happened, some seed fell along the path, and the birds came and devoured it. Other seed fell on rocky ground, and when the sun rose, it was scorched. Other seed fell among thorns, and the thorns grew up and choked it. Other seeds fell into good earth, and it gave fruit and yielded 30-fold, 60-fold, and 100-fold. If we disregard the way too familiar allegorical reading, the seed is the word and Satan is the birds who take away the word, what do we hear? What does the parable say if we allow it to stand alone the way Jesus originally told it? Look at the balance of the composition. Three clear streams of thought organizing the contents. The seed is dispersed and falls in four different places: along the path, on rocky ground, among thorns, and into good earth. In each of the first three places, the seed meets with its demise. Yet in the fourth place, the seed not only finds fertile soil and takes root, it produces a phenomenal yield, 30-fold, 60-fold, 100-fold. So what's the sower up to? John Dominic Crossan says, this is a parable about parabling. Like sowing, parabling involves losses and gains, failures and successes. To parable is to trust the audience. But then, according to Whedon, it's not about parabling, not about the word, not about the soil. It's about hope. How? Well, first, Let me remind you of a fancy seminary word, theodicy. It's a combination of two Greek words, theos, God, and dike, order. Theodicy is an argument or attempt to account for God's goodness and power in light of the existence of evil. As the argument goes, if God is all-loving and all-powerful, how do you account for evil in the world? I mean, really, you can only have a God that is all-loving or all-powerful, but you can't have both. But that's a conversation for another time. Theodicy tries to make sense of a world where bad things happen to good people and good things happen to bad people. Whedon and others have suggested that the parable of the sower is an almost Ecclesiastes-like acknowledgement of, for everything, there is a season. The sower in our parable is the giver of life. But anybody who's ever had a garden, let alone been a farmer, knows that the reality of the forces arrayed against a successful harvest are huge. So the parable also has takers of life, birds, sun, and thorns. Yet all of these factors, in and of themselves, are not evil. In fact, every single one of them promotes growth. Birds help disperse seeds. Thorns are a defense mechanism protecting certain plants from predators. And without the sun, of course, there couldn't be life at all. They're simply representative of natural forces. Though inherently good and life-promoting, they continually rub up against each other, resulting in outcomes that are both beneficial and dead ends. You could almost read the parable from an evolutionary perspective, given that when the environment is right, some seeds will flourish and the others, ill-adapted for their place, perish. In Living the Questions, Painting the Stars series on science, religion, and an evolving faith, scientist, Lutheran pastor, and professor Dr. Barbara Rossing talks about the brand new concept shaking up academia when she was a geology student in the 1970s. That crazy new idea was called tectonic plates. That's right, in the 1970s. When meteorologist Alfred Wegener first proposed what he then called continental drift back in 1912, he was discredited as a kook. But after over 50 years of debate and testing, the scientific community finally convinced itself that the theory was accurate, revolutionizing the earth sciences. Only the most recalcitrant flat earthers and young earthers would try and deny that for billions of years, huge continent-sized plates have been moving across the surface of the earth. But are they inherently good? Evil? Or is that the wrong question altogether? Sure, they're responsible for earthquakes, volcanoes, and even tsunamis. But without them, there'd be no Mount Everest or Grand Canyon. The disciples would have no Sea of Galilee to fish in because the only reason the Sea of Galilee exists is because the African and Arabian plates are trying to get the better of each other. And as we can see on the news right now, there'd be no Mauna Kea erupting to help create the Hawaiian Islands. Marsupials may never have evolved in Australia, and maybe, just maybe, human life as we know it wouldn't even exist. In the deepest of troughs in the oceans, hydrothermal vents called deep ocean black smokers have been discovered, and they spout a hot chemical soup from which it's been proposed some of the basic building blocks of life itself first came together. Is this good? Evil? Again, probably the wrong question. But what we know is that at 2,500 feet below the surface, at over 700 degrees Fahrenheit, under 3,600 pounds per square inch of pressure, not only is life thriving, but the building blocks of new life exists. In all those otherwise adverse conditions, life has found a way. And who knows if we as a species aren't part of the 30-fold, 60-fold, or 100-fold yield that comes from this underwater chaos. Look, there are lots of ways to interpret this parable, but the one I'd like to embrace is the message of possibilities. That in a world where forces, not inherently good or evil, constantly, well, rub up against one another, there is always hope of something new. It's not in spite of, but because these forces are working against each other, that circumstances are created by which something no one ever dreamed of can come into existence. By examining our parable from another angle, minus the allegory, we find a plausible interpretation that suggests that another reading of the parable is an attempt to make sense of the existence of evil in the world. In other words, wrestling with theodicy. And not just wrestling with it, but creating hope for something new. In his book, The Myth of Innocence, Mark and Christian Origins, Burton Mack says, "This is a parable of hope. It's an attempt to account for natural evil and show that despite the struggles inherent in living, the prospects are good for life. Despite setbacks and frustrations, the cosmos is an extension of the life-giving force of the Creator. And the reality is that some of the seeds, in fact, many of the seeds, survive to sprout into fruition, 30-fold, 60-fold, even 100-fold. This is a great parable for today, but only without the tortured allegory about Satan, persecution, temptation, and greed. There are a lot of both lifelong Christians and church alumni who are discouraged about the dogma and hypocrisy of conventional or traditional Christianity, and rightfully so, because we've let allegories and fantasy cloud the radical and very practical nature of Jesus' vision for a new world. Because of that, many of our kids and grandkids have completely checked out of Christianity altogether. Well, the parable of the sower says, don't get discouraged. Loss is a part of the process from the beginning, and who knows, a whole new expression of faith that none of us has ever envisioned may be the result when the next generation gets to it. What are we to do in the meantime? We can remember that this parable suggests that opposition and difficulty is to be expected. Right now, prejudice, bigotry, white supremacy, and Christian nationalism is not only on the rise, it's being promoted by many churches. Those of us that are trying to broaden the scope of belief or practice in following Jesus can throw up our hands in frustration. Oh my, this environment is too harsh for our seed to take root. Or we can remember that what today's parable demonstrates is that, yes, bad things happen. 75% of everything the farmer puts out there is eaten, choked, or burnt up. But given that kind of pushback, given the right kind of friction, something completely new and unexpected can come to fruition from what remains 30-fold, 60-fold, 100-fold. Once upon a time, a frustrated student asked a rabbi, "How could God create a world with so much pain and suffering?" The rabbi replied, "Do you think you could have done a better job? Then what are you waiting for?" What are you waiting for? In Jeff and my book, Living the Questions, we recalled the story about Rabbi Harold Kushner's son, Aaron, being born with progeria, a rare and incurable disease that causes rapid aging and early death. Kushner was forced to reconsider his view of God as an all-powerful force who controls everything with a master plan that humans simply don't understand. His response, preserved in his book, When Bad Things Happen to Good People, was hailed by many as a new understanding of God. But what Kushner and the mystics of all time have known was that he was really only shining a light on ancient, long-established wisdom. Kushner knew better than to try to explain the why of it all. That's not what the Bible or deep faith is about. What he came to the conclusion of was a lot like the point of our parable today. When bad things happen, maybe the reason is because that's the way life is. The real question remains, one that you'll recognize as yet another of Jesus' cliffhanger endings: what are you going to do about it? The sower went out to sow, and even in the face of everything negative that life could throw at his efforts, some of the seed came to fruition, just like it always does. So what are you hesitating for? Don't give up hope. Keep sowing, and let anyone with ears to hear listen. Be well.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.wepuTloveFirst.org.